From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. In a busy world, the Middle East has not been a top priority for this White House. But today, President Biden starts a four-day trip there, his first to the Mideast since taking office. Here he is in Jerusalem.
I'm proud to say that our relationship with the State of Israel is deeper and stronger, in my view, than it's ever been. And with this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further.
Later this week, he is off to the occupied West Bank and then Saudi Arabia. Daniel Estrin is NPR's international correspondent, and he's in Jerusalem covering the visit. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Scott.
Bone deep. Those are the words President Biden used to describe U.S.-Israeli ties upon landing there today. What will he try to achieve in Israel?
That's right. He's trying to reassure Israelis is what he's trying to do. We saw him being very chummy with Israeli officials on the tarmac, a lot of fist bumps. And Israelis are still sizing him up. You know, many Israelis were enthusiastic about former President Trump, who sided with Israel and not the Palestinians on a lot of contested issues. And so, you know, as the deputy mayor of Jerusalem told me a couple days ago, Israelis would like to believe Biden has their back. So that's what Biden is trying to do, set a good first impression. Mm-hmm. He is going to be releasing a statement with the Israelis outlining their relationship between the U.S. and Israel in the coming years. That's an attempt at reaching some mutual understandings where there are still a lot of differences, especially about the Iran nuclear deal, which Biden supports and Israel is wary about.
On Friday, the president is planning to meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in the occupied West Bank. This level of engagement with the Palestinians is a departure from the Trump administration. What will Biden have to offer the Palestinians?
Well, that's a tricky one because, you know, after the Trump administration sidelined Palestinians, the U.S. Mm-hmm. now wants to rebalance its relationship with the Palestinians. But quite frankly, Biden is kind of boxed in. It's politically sensitive for him now to reopen diplomatic offices for Palestinians in Jerusalem and in Washington. And then legislation that Trump himself signed into office limits the kinds of support that the U.S. can offer Palestinians. One thing that the U.S. can do is offer funding to hospitals, and that is what Biden is expected to do. He's expected to announce $100 million to Palestinian hospitals. But Biden is not launching a peace process. That's what he said today, that a Palestinian state is not on the horizon anytime soon. So we're going to see some goodwill gestures, is what Israel calls it, for Palestinians. None of this really offers Palestinians any sense that the U.S. is pushing for a clear political track to solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, as you're mentioning, the White House is lowering expectations for deliverables, as they say, in general on this trip. But Israel is seeking a broader integration with the Arab world. Can the president help speed that up?
Speed up, I'm not sure. I think it's a little bit about slow and steady.
Okay.
Israel wants Biden to advance Israeli-Saudi normalization, as they call it, formal diplomatic ties, after the Abraham Accords, the deals between Israel and some Arab countries in recent years. Mm-hmm. There is some talk about some steps, like maybe an air defense cooperation between Israel and the region. It's a little bit premature right now. So small steps, but not a big Israel-Saudi deal yet.
Saudi Arabia is, of course, the last step on this trip. Saudi Arabia is a huge oil exporter, and we know where crude oil prices in the world are right now. You know, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia has long been underpinned by this notion of security in exchange for energy. Is that still an important subtext here?
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, the question is whether Saudi Arabia's output of oil can actually impact gas prices. Biden has been very clear that domestic U.S. concerns, namely high oil prices and gas prices, are what is behind a lot of this trip. And I don't think we're going to hear any announcements about Saudi oil production until the end of the trip, until the Saudis see how President Biden greets, for instance, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who the U.S. has implicated in the killing of dissident Jamal Khashoggi.
Well, and President Biden, in his campaign, famously called Saudi Arabia a pariah in the world. So now, given he's planning to meet the Saudi Crown Prince, how is the White House trying to finesse this messaging?
Well, Biden put it in a Washington Post op-ed over the weekend. He said that the U.S. is not seeking to rupture ties with Saudi Arabia. And he said it's interests that when you look at the world and when the U.S. wants to counter Russia and to outpace and outcompete China, that the U.S. needs Saudi Arabia on its side for that. What a lot of us are going to be looking at is what kind of interaction Biden will have with the Crown Prince, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, perhaps an uncomfortable meeting with the Saudi Crown Prince.
That is Daniel Estrin, NPR's international correspondent in Jerusalem following the president's visit to the Middle East. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the latest inflation report is out today, and it's not good. In June, prices were up 0.5% from May and over 9% compared to a year ago. That's even higher than economists expected. In fact, it's a 40-year high. Everything got more expensive last month. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi is here, thankfully. Ali, not good.
It's not good at all. If I were pressed to find a silver lining in here, most of it is energy. Now, that's cold comfort to anybody who consumes energy, which is 100% of us. But it's if it were structural, meaning for it were in every basket that we measure for inflation, I'd be very worried that this is across the board inflation. And the only way to combat this is surging interest rates, which causes a recession. The fact that it is still about energy prices, largely to do with the embargoes that we've got on Russian energy, means that there might be a creative solution to this that doesn't push us into a recession. But I will say the odds have increased that we're going to end up in a recession, because the only way to fight this is to keep increasing, generally speaking, is to keep increasing interest rates.
Well, let's get at all of that. We just heard President Biden is going to be asking the Saudis to increase oil production. More oil means there's more to go around, and it brings the prices down. And because you've explained to us, you know, there is job growth and consumer demand. That's good.
Yes.
Until there's not enough to buy, which is happening. The supply and energy shortages caused by the pandemic and Russia's war, you just explained that. Not enough things, prices get raised so manufacturers can make their money. So when does that stop? I mean, is it just about gas prices coming down if we can produce more gas and oil to bring the prices down?
Well, they're mathematically, the whole idea of demand outstripping supply stops in two ways. Either the supply increases, i.e. more oil is produced, which, by the way, climate activists hate that idea, or demand falls. And a recession or high gas prices are what cause that to fall. And by the way, that applies to the entire economy, right? We've got food increases because we're not getting wheat out of Ukraine. We've got supply chain issues. We've got semiconductors that are in short supply. So the only two ways to fix this is either you have more of the stuff or you curtail the demand. Interest rates are the way we curtail demand. So you've got two things going on. You've got prices going up. That curtails demand because people will say, maybe I don't have to buy that car this year or that dishwasher, I'll buy it next year or the year after. That could create a recession.
Right.
And the actual idea that these interest rates are up, so I can't put it on my credit card. I don't want to carry a loan. A business can't buy money to expand. So that's the problem. This is much more art than it is science.
Right.
That's the formula for fixing it. But the formula is often not done right.
It's Goldilocks. And
yes,
the Fed has been raising interest rates for the past several months now. And again, raising interest rates increases the borrowing costs for not just companies, but consumers. You know, what you carry on your credit card, that weighs on, brings down economic activity. But if you bring it out too far, people aren't buying anything, and then that's bad.
Right. And there's no science to this. As much as this happens on a regular basis, we've never perfected the speed at which you raise interest rates to slow down the economy.
Well, and what was disturbing is that the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, even said recently, we now understand better how little we understand about inflation. So what do you think about the more increases in rates?
Look, they're going to happen, and there are a number of people who say it's too much and it's too fast and the Fed should stop. Bank of America came out this morning after the inflation numbers came out and said, we now predict a recession will occur this year. It will recover in 2023. And by the way, their projection is not for a big recession. It's for a negative growth of about 1.3% or something. That's not a big recession. We can handle small recessions. But there are people who say maybe the Fed should stop now, which makes sense until next month when we get another report that inflation is 8% or 9% or 10%, and people get mad. They're saying, I'm buying the same stuff for more money, or I'm getting less stuff for the same money. It happens every time somebody fills their gas tank. And they get mad, and that becomes a political issue, because then it becomes a throw-the-bums-out thing, and nobody who's in political power wants to be the party or the president or the governor who presided over this inflation. So that's when the math, the economics, the psychology, and the politics all come together, and it is a very hard cake to bake.
Well, and given all the reasons behind this inflation, no bum is going to be able to, you know, maybe figure it out any better. And if people say, I'm, you know, a pox on all of you, I'm not buying anything, well, then companies start laying people off and firing
that's
people.
That's exactly right.
And then we go into that well. Wow, this has been fun. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you.
My pleasure.
We'll check back in with you. Maybe better news. A new poll out today might cause Democrats to do a double take. The Politico Morning Consult poll shows that Democrats have a 4-point advantage over Republicans in a generic congressional ballot for the November midterm elections. What? President Biden's job approval numbers are in the low 30s, and his aides are reportedly concerned that an aging Biden is leading a rudderless White House into a ditch. It could be that Democrats are benefiting from former President Trump driving his whole party into a ditch, as the January 6th hearings are driving home. But for the next few minutes, how are Democrats viewing Biden? Christopher Scott is chief political officer at the progressive group Democracy for America. He's based in Cincinnati, Ohio. Chris, surprising poll, but do you think it offsets known frustrations with Biden?
Well, I think the frustrations have just kept mounting for this administration at this point. I think we have seen an administration that has been consistently out of touch with the voters that help put them there in the first place. And so I immediately think of just the comments this past week about activists needing to be more in touch with the mainstream Democratic Party. These activists are the mainstream Democratic Party. They're the black and brown voters. You need to put that coalition back together if Democrats are going to have any chance of success in these midterms.
Well, let's take up that debate within the party, because that debate was held recently on CNN in a segment where you had Democratic strategist Joe Trippi, who is white, saying it was crazy talk. And he said dividing the party has never helped them win before. Then you had Nina Turner, the strategist, who is black, vehemently disagreeing. I mean, her hair was on fire. And she called the Supreme Court's rulings, including about guns, but also overturning the constitutional right to Roe v. Wade. She said these were about life and death for many Americans. Then she kind of exploded. Here's what she said.
We should measure based on what is best for Big Mama and Big Daddy in hoods where people are misunderstood, whether it's the rural hood, the urban hood, or the suburban hood. That is how you settle whether or not there will be a primary deliver for the people.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, absolutely. We have consistently ostracized and ignored the people that are closest to the pain, which, again, more often than not, they're black and brown, they're the working class, and this administration has been consistently out of touch. Beyond the issue of abortion and everything being threatened with women's reproductive rights, we've seen administration slow to respond in ensuring voting rights. We have seen an administration not come through with what they said they were going to do when it comes to alleviating student debt. And it's going to cost us big time if we don't get it together.
Well, but let's take up the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. President Biden got hammered for saying that the solution to that was to go out and vote. But then others are saying, you know, he's kind of right. There aren't the votes in Congress to codify abortion rights through legislation. He did sign an executive action that safeguards some access to contraception, but you know, what else can he do? People voted for Donald Trump, who put in three Supreme Court members.
So I think part of the issue with the response is just how delayed everything came from him. Yes, we know we have to go vote. That is always one of the solutions to everything, but there always has to be more. When you look at him just doing the executive action, it's great that he did it, but it seemed like the administration was grotesquely just ill-prepared to handle that decision coming down, even though they knew it was coming. So I think that's the frustration that you're hearing. Yeah. How did you not have more in place? Why are you not willing to do more and hold the line and be bolder and be proactive in a moment like this?
Well, and I'm citing others, The Economist, Ann Owen, who said if people are looking for Biden to do something to bring inflation down right away, he doesn't have the tools to do that. People think that presidents have sometimes more tools than they do. Here's another one. Barbara Perry, a presidential scholar at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, said, we think of presidents as being so powerful, but they don't have often the tools we think they have. And then she added, though, and Joe Biden doesn't have the communication skills that, let's say, a Ronald Reagan had. Is that part of the problem? I mean, let's just be blunt. Do you think he is increasingly looking too old in how he holds himself, how he walks, how he speaks, that somehow that's telegraphing the wrong thing?
At this moment, I think it's unfortunate he is looking a little dated. When you talk about how he was elected, he talked about being the man for the moment, the only person that could beat Donald Trump, the only person that can unify this country. I think one of the biggest failings of this administration is looking at how they did not properly deploy even their own vice president, Kamala Harris, who I think would have been a perfect person to put out there in a more proactive role. I definitely get why people are feeling that, because you're just looking at the response and he looks tired. He looks like he's tired of the fighting. And that is not what he sold the American people yeah. on. It wasn't just about beating Trump. It was about being right for these moments like yeah. this.
That's Christopher Scott, chief political officer at DFA, the progressive group Democracy for America. Chris, thanks so much for weighing in.
Thanks so much, Robin.
In Australia, the prime minister yesterday promised a new era of climate action, as in lower emissions and more money for renewables. And this could be a big opportunity for Aussie native Saul Griffith. He is a celebrated engineer, and he happens to be a MacArthur Genius Award winner. Griffith had been living in this country, but recently he moved back to his native Australia. And there he is launching a campaign for more solar panels on rooftops. John Kalish reports.
Saul Griffith recently appeared on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation TV show Q+A, discussing the country's energy crisis with such policy heavyweights as the Minister of Energy and Climate Change and a former Prime Minister.
We're going to have a lot more solar on rooftops because that's the cheapest form of electricity that exists today and will in the future. We're going to put electric vehicles in all the driveways. And we now need to start to think about 10 million Australian households as infrastructure.
Many of those 10 million Australian households know the name Saul Griffith. The 48-year-old engineer is passionate about replacing fossil fuels by electrifying all residential energy appliances and transitioning to electric vehicles.
I'm in Australia with the belief that climate action can happen here faster than the US. So at the end of the day, what I'm trying to do here is run the world's first whole suburb electrification pilot project.
Griffith is calling the project Suburb Zero, in other words, electricity with zero fossil fuel emissions. Rooftop solar is a major element in the project. Griffith is currently living with his wife and kids in Wollongong, a coastal town with a 250,000 residents south of Sydney. It's one of the areas under consideration as a Suburb Zero locale, and it's also the town Dave Elkin lives in.
In Australia, we're blessed with having a lot of sunshine, so I wanted to take advantage of that.
Elkin is a 42-year-old software developer whose home is all electric. He drives a Tesla when he's not biking, and his rooftop solar panels charge the company's Powerwall battery system.
When you generate your own energy, you can use far more than you otherwise would. The cost is more stable, and understood on a day-by-day basis. You're not subject to swings in prices, which can come out of nowhere.
Electric rates in Australia have soared in recent years. That and the trauma of climate crisis-related weather events, including wildfires, are factors in rooftop solar's boom in Australia. 25% of Australian households are equipped with rooftop solar. With government subsidies, the payback time for a residential solar array is less than 5 years, says Muriel Watt. She's been involved in researching and consulting on solar energy for more than 40 years. Watt says that government and utilities are now grappling with how to integrate all that small-scale solar power into the electrical grid.
With so many people in Australia having their own power system on their roof and also going to have their own battery and have their own electric vehicle, they're not interested in having someone on high telling them what they can and can't do and when they can and can't do it.
The debate about how power from small-scale solar is managed, says Watt, includes controlling the way electric vehicles are charged at home.
We're going to have to really think about how those are powered and what the peak load impact is for the network.
With minimal bureaucracy for permitting in Australia, rooftop solar there is about a third of the cost of rooftop solar in the U.S. Saul Griffith says getting appliance manufacturers, government, and utilities to cooperate with his Suburb Zero project will be much easier because that rooftop electricity is so cheap. Still, Griffith realizes that rewiring Australia is a monumental task.
This is an impossible thing that can only happen if you manifest it. And the only way you manifest it is by telling a lot of stories to a lot of people until you get them to agree that the manifest should be real. So it's swing for the fences.
Griffith says he'll probably be doing Australia's first solar suburb in 2023, but in the meantime, he's been traveling around the country holding town halls to drum up support for the Suburb Zero project. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Here in D.C., the nation honors a pioneer of education and civil rights, African-American Mary McLeod Bethune. A statue of Bethune was unveiled today at the National Statuary Hall Collection in the Capitol Building. It replaces a statue of a Confederate general. This new statue is one of two chosen by the state of Florida. Here's Florida Representative Kathy Castor, a Democrat.
We lift her up today at a time of competing ideologies to help heal and unify through her example, because she also lived at a time of division, but determined to stand up to dissenting voices, including the Ku Klux Klan, to do what many said could not be done.
Let's learn a little more now about Bethune from Julius John. He's professor of communication and theater at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach, Florida. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Your university's namesake, Mary McLeod Bethune, born in a cabin in South Carolina, daughter of two formerly enslaved people, what did she go on to do?
Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, an extraordinary educator, civil rights leader, government official, which is why I'm certain she has been placed in Statuary Hall.
I understand she advised FDR and was a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt, yeah?
She was, absolutely. She assisted four different presidents. He being one. She was also the founder of the National Council of Negro Women. She actually opened one of the first schools for African American girls.
Yes.
You know, we all hear the story of $1.50, you know, in Daytona Beach, Florida. Which ended up becoming Bethune-Cookman University.
I'm sorry to stop you. What is that story? $1.50. I don't know it.
Oh, you don't know? Well, that's what she bought. The land is technically sitting on dump grounds. She purchased the land for $1.50, and she erected the first school for African American girls.
$1.50. Right. I mean, a bargain on the order of Manhattan.
$1.50. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So don't take it lightly, because she faced a lot of not just adversity, but she faced a lot of Ku Klux Klan and everything else as she was doing that, but she stood her ground, so to speak. She changed the lives of many, and she continued to change the lives of many.
Now, in Statuary Hall, there are already statues of African Americans that aren't part of this National Statuary Hall collection, but if you go into Statuary Hall today, you also see Frederick Douglass, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr. What does this new statue of Mary McLeod Bethune add? There are a lot of field trips, and students will be walking through and seeing these notable persons, including these notable African Americans in American history.
To be quite honest, it just adds another layer of African Americans' contributions to the United States. And definitely, she's sitting among greats. And so I'm sure they're welcoming her with open arms. Mm-hmm. Her legacy lives and will always live.
Julius John, professor of communication and theater at Bethune-Cookman University in Florida. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
If you have spent the last year in a funk of negative feelings, well, the people of the world are with you. A new Gallup survey finds the world is more unhappy and more stressed than ever. The survey team interviewed more than 120,000 people across 122 countries and found that 2021 left people feeling more negative than any previous year. Yeah, no, I'm stressed. Let's go through it now with Julie Ray, managing editor for World News at Gallup. Julie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you about the key findings of the survey. Just how stressed out are we as a global society right now?
So we've been seeing negative emotions rise within the last decade specifically. Hmm. And stress, you know, of course, during the pandemic, we saw in the first year, we saw it jump up 5 points, which was it's a huge change.
Wow.
For the world.
Yeah. But when you look at the trajectory, this is not just a pandemic story here.
Right. That's exactly right. Stress levels, worry levels, sadness, all of that has been rising since about 2011. We've seen upticks almost every single year. The unique thing about the data in 2021 that we hadn't seen for a number of years is that with this increase in negative emotions, we saw for the first time in 2021 a decrease in people's positive experiences. We're seeing kind of a double whammy emotionally with people having more negative experiences and less joy.
Yeah. And does your poll explore the why? Why is this the case?
You know, it doesn't. We ask people about their positive and negative experiences. And of course, we ask them a lot of other questions about what's going on in their lives, economically, whether they have enough food and shelter, or whether they have confidence in their institution. So we have all that to kind of give context to their emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. as we regard it. And of course, you know, you can tell by what's going on in the country. You know, of course, in Afghanistan, we saw just negative experiences go through the roof, but we were also collecting data at the same time that the U.S. was withdrawing and the Taliban was taking control.
Can I ask you a little bit more about Afghanistan? It's ranked as the least positive country for several years in a row. Tell us a little bit more about how Afghans are feeling.
You know, we've seen heightened levels of stress and worry and sadness and all these negative emotions among Afghans for a number of years. But 2021 just basically kind of blew the roof off of all the previous findings. Afghans are more worried, stressed than anybody else has ever been in the history that we've been looking at these data.
Yeah. Finally, Julie, I wonder if this is one of those cases where two things can be true at the same time. On one hand, there are these perceptions, this trend in perceptions of negative feelings that you find in your polls. But if you look at some economic indicators, you know, how much money we're taking in per capita, that's going up. People are going about their lives. How do you put that together? Or is that kind of beyond the scope of a poll like this?
Well, I think that these data provide another insight into people's daily lives that you can't get from looking at how well they're, you know, from GDP. You can't, just like if you're going to a doctor, you know, the doctor can't tell just based off of your temperature, you know, if you're sick.
Give me some good news in this survey. Do you have any?
I do. So we had seen, and of course this makes perfect sense, but in 2020, people were smiling or laughing less the previous day. We saw that started to rebound in 2021.
Well, there's a start. I like it. Julie Ray, Managing Editor for World News at Gallup. Julie, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, to Ukraine now, where the government is taking extraordinary measures to fight Russia's invasion. In an effort to maintain a united front, officials have consolidated the country's television outlets and dissolved its political parties. NPR's Emily Fang reports from Kyiv.
Before the war, Ukraine had a dizzying array of television news stations. But in March, President Zelensky decided to consolidate them into one 24-hour channel. But not all stations were included. This is the swanky studio for Kyiv-based television station Priyami, which means direct. It was once owned by former Ukrainian president and billionaire Petro Poroshenko. He was also a political competitor of Zelensky's, and Priyami's reports have been excluded from the new national broadcast and most cable networks.
We were switched off from digital broadcast and excluded from the national channel. We have not been provided any reasons for this.
This is Svetlana Orlovska, the executive producer. Before the war, she was concerned mostly with keeping her anchors happy and the shows running on time. Now she's worried about the network's survival.
We do hope we can begin broadcasting again after Ukraine wins the war. But during the martial law, there are certain restrictions. We cannot oppose our exclusion.
Even before Russia invaded in February, some of Ukraine's opposition media outlets said they faced political pressure from President Zelensky's government. Volodymyr Mezhelsky directs one of Ukraine's oldest television stations, Channel 5. It was also previously owned by former President Poroshenko, who sold his media holdings under a 2021 Ukrainian law.
After Channel 5 was sold, the government suspected the sale was false, and Poroshenko still controlled the station. We felt consistently pressure from institutions like the broadcast regulator. We have numerous lawsuits filed against us by current and former members of parliament.
Why the government attention, I ask him.
I think we were switched off because there was a fear that this time we would not support the president's point of view.
Late last year, Zelensky announced Poroshenko was being investigated for treason. And this past March, 11 political parties were suspended, and any of their elected members dismissed from office for being pro-Russian. Most were fringe, but one party had nearly 10% of seats in Ukraine's parliament. Ukraine's Minister of Culture tells NPR Ukraine also had to take a stronger anti-Russian stance when it came to the country's media landscape.
During the last several years, we definitely realized what does it mean, Russian propagandistic machine. To be united in the time of war, it means that we need to coordinate our efforts.
And he characterized the lack of any opposition outlets from Ukraine's new national broadcast channel as simply a lack of space.
It's a tricky issue how to include newcomers.
And Russian interference in Ukraine is a real problem, especially now that there's a hot war with Russia. Another political opponent, the pro-Russian billionaire Viktor Medvedchuk, was recently arrested and his business assets seized because of his close ties to Vladimir Putin. Victoria Sumar is a member of parliament and part of the same political party as Poroshenko, technically making her the opposition to Zelensky's party. But she stresses she's still a patriot.
Today, I believe in Ukraine that there are no anti-government opposition forces. All Ukrainian politicians are united in opposition to Putin and Putin's Russia.
But she does have some complaints about Zelensky's government.
The first difference is their attitude towards freedom of speech. We fiercely oppose the government on this.
Restrictions on these worry the opposition. namely that Zelensky is clearing out political rivals before the 2024 presidential election. Before the war, he was a deeply unpopular president.
I think there is such a danger of centralization of power, of even authoritarian tendencies.
Andreas Umland is at the Swedish Institute of International Affairs. And he says an adversarial, highly personal party dynamic drives Ukrainian politics.
Parties disappear, new parties arrive, parties transform. And often the fate of a party is very much tied to the fate of the leader.
But despite the restrictions placed under martial law, Umland does not believe Ukraine will ultimately trend authoritarian.
Well, about this sort of now already established consensus in society that there should be always an opposition, there should be different voices.
These questions have become only more important as Ukraine tries to join the European Union. Not only does it have to win a war against Russia, it'll have to prove it's a stable government with democratic institutions like a free press. Emily Fang, NPR News, Kyiv.
The energy giant Shell plans to open a new multi-billion dollar petrochemical plant along the Ohio River this summer. The massive industrial site will use natural gas drilled and fracked in western Pennsylvania to make tiny plastic pellets, and they will be used as raw material to make other plastic products. But these pellets can sometimes end up in the water. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant took a boat ride with workers hunting for plastic in the river. And here's what she found.
Captain Evan Clark leads cleanup groups in the rivers near Pittsburgh. He's the Three Rivers waterkeeper and is amazed at how many plastic bottles, grocery bags, and thin films, like the ones that cover cigarette packs, they find in the rivers.
That such a massive percent of what we pull out of the river is plastics is really eye-opening and educational.
Clark pulls the waterkeeper boat to the side of the Ohio River at the boat launch in Monaca, a few miles upriver from Shell's plant. He's bundled up in waders and a hoodie to protect him from the wind. Eric Harder, the Yucagani River keeper, is among a few others waiting to get on board. They're headed out to look for a different kind of plastic, nurdles.
I'd say most people do not know what a nurdle was when I first, would tell them about it.
Nurdles are tiny pieces of plastic the size of a lentil. They're the raw material used by manufacturers to make other plastic products. It takes more than 350 nurdles for one yogurt cup and over 1,000 nurdles to make a soda bottle. The boat passes Shell's huge new industrial facility high on the bank. When it opens, it will make 1.6 million metric tons of plastic pellets a year. And sometimes those tiny bits can spill. This has happened in Texas, Louisiana, and elsewhere. Nurdles have spilled from plants owned by other companies. Containers of them have fallen off ships and train cars. Unknown tons of the tiny pellets wind up in the waterways and mix with the sand on shorelines. Fish and birds can ingest them. The environmental groups are on today's patrol, surveying for nurdles now, to build a baseline of plastics in the river so they can tell if there are any spills from the Shell plant after it opens. They stop the boat, and using a metal pole, Eric Harder lowers a large sock-like filter onto the surface of the water to catch debris. Then they wait for 10 minutes. They pull the filter sock out of the water and empty the contents through a sieve into a bucket. James Cato of Mountain Watershed Association inspects the debris. He points out a piece of hard, dense plastic, a nurdle. It's a dull, yellowish color.
And that also looked to me like a nurdle. And it still has that kind of glowing quality. And then the other ones are yellowed, and they've been eroded down into more irregular shapes. So who knows how long they've been out here.
Cato pulls out an amber-colored vial and drops in one of the nurdles. They go through this protocol at set locations up and downriver of the Shell plant and send the nurdles they find to researchers they've partnered with at local universities. The scientists will analyze their chemical makeup and see if other pollutants in the water are concentrating on the surface of the nurdles. The coalition will also survey for nurdles on the riverbanks, look for them in fish guts, and monitor water quality near Shell's plant before and after it opens.
Obviously, it's a massive, massive corporation, so we're definitely up against it in that way. And I do think that, you know, should something happen, we're really collecting the data that we need to back us up.
Mike Blackhurst of the University of Pittsburgh organized the partnership. He admits getting baseline data for nurdles in the river will be difficult.
I don't want to be too much of a wet blanket, but as someone who has good statistical modeling skills, you know, you do need a lot of samples to be able to show change with some level of significance.
Blackhurst is more confident that drone footage could tell them if there are spills coming from the Shell plant, and water quality sampling could assess changes at those times. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection declined an interview, but noted that plastic pellets discharged from the plant are regulated under the state's environmental laws and that the Shell plant will be subject to regular inspections. Shell said in an email that the pellets produced at the plant, quote, cannot be allowed to make their way into local waterways under any circumstances, and that the company built multiple barriers to capture any plastics that may spill at the plant. Still, Captain Evan Clark thinks the more nurdle patrols they do and the more people hear about it, the better.
Not only just to Shell, but to everybody else who's interested in this, in the plastic issue, seeing that people are taking it seriously enough to spend the time and the money to be out here doing the work does a ton to just raise the visibility.
And with more petrochemical plants like this under consideration along the Ohio River, Clark hopes this monitoring effort will help protect the water from plastic pollution. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
And a quick note, the plastic research partnership mentioned in the story has funding from the Heinz Endowments, which also supports the Allegheny Front journalists. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.